Okay, so I think we're broadcasting and recording now, right, Steve?
Yes.
Okay, so it's 2:01 on Tuesday, December 17th. This is the meeting of the technology subgroup to the Colorado Voter Access and Modernized Elections Commission. This meeting, notice for this meeting was went out, I think, last Friday for this location. In the room here, we've got Steve Ward, who provides assistance to the board. My name's Trevor Timmons with the Secretary of State's office.
Jonathan Troll with OIT.
And Gary Van Stel with Jefferson County.
And then on the line, we've got, go ahead, Tim.
Tim Bishop, El Paso County.
And then we also have, go ahead, Rick.
Rick Matsumoto, OIT.
And then do we have any other participants on the phone?
Renee Loy with Delta County.
Renee, good to have you, Renee.
Thank you.
Where are you from, Renee?
Delta.
Delta? Okay.
Delta County.
All right. Thank you.
And Trevor, this is Vanessa Conway with the Secretary of State's office.
Hi, Vanessa. Good to have you aboard.
Hi.
So, and I don't know if all of you have met Vanessa. Vanessa is she's in our policy unit downstairs. She works directly for the Deputy Secretary of State. Vanessa has the she has the great good fortune to actually assemble, I think, the initial draft of the January 2014 report by the commission that will be presented to the General Assembly. And then I think she's taking inputs from the business practices subgroup as well as this group. And then she's going to magically turn that into a publication-ready report for the legislature. Right, Vanessa?
Well, something like that, yeah.
See, she doesn't even sound scared. She's all over it. No, that's great. I appreciate you taking the time. I've got a couple things to go over first. I distributed, and Tim, I think you, well, I know you received a copy. Renee, I don't know that you received a copy of the agenda items for discussion document that we went over at the first meeting of the technology subgroup, kind of identifying those areas that we wanted to consider for inclusion in that January 2014 report, and then obviously to form, you know, a basis for work of this subgroup going forward in supporting the commission in reporting on the 1303 implementation. And Renee, I'll correct that error right after this meeting. Come on in, Amber.
Okay, that's fine.
And Amber McReynolds has just joined us. So I think we actually have every named member of the technology subgroup with the exception of Representative Max Tyler, which is pretty good.
Hi, I'm Max Tyler.
Hi. Have a seat.
Thank you.
So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Sorry, I'm late. This is State Representative Jonathan Singer. Representative Tyler couldn't make it today, so I was appointed in his stead.
Thank you, Jonathan. So we've got a couple of Jonathans here. That's good. It's always good.
Nothing wrong with that.
Always good.
So the basis on which we started the first meeting of this technology subgroup is to identify the areas, again, that we want to consider for inclusion in that January report of the commission, and then things we'll focus on going forward. And so I think everyone except Renee probably has this list in front of them. And so just briefly, I'm going to list those, and then I want to speak a little more in depth on item one. Item one being the electronic poll book RFP evaluation and possible implementation. The second item is voter service and polling center flow, which I think our work in my discussions with Hillary Hall and at the last business practices group, I think we decided that that really needs to start with kind of the boots on the ground, the local election officials who actually, you know, understand the process and the flow of elections more so than I would, And then business practices may identify some of those issues around around registration, around issuance of ballots, around assigning vote credit and training judges. And then the technology subgroup may contribute to that as needed. Same for the third item on the agenda, national change of address policies, processes, and best practices. Again, I think business practices would, put their eyes on that and maybe identify, those best practices, and then technology would actually look at that, as needed. We talked extensively, I think, about locations and planning for voter service and polling centers at our last meeting. And as I said at the last meeting, I think about a third of the counties in the state have experience with vote centers, which is a form of electronic poll book. It's not precinct-based polling locations. So at least a third of the counties kind of have an understanding of what that is to set up those locations, provide for network connectivity, kind of prepare for crowd flow and all that sort of thing, whereas a number of counties don't have that kind of experience. And I think that experience with voter service and polling centers will be different than it was in vote centers, primarily because mail ballots are going out to everyone. And I think we discovered in 2013, most people are actually voting that mail ballot rather than walking in and choosing to vote in person. And so the kind of the flow of people walking in to exercise their right to vote, is going to be different. But again, that starts more with the business process and how local election officials plan for and then run those elections. And then the technology subgroup may need to jump in on that, in some specific areas. The fifth item that we discussed last time was data interfaces. The 1303 contemplated more frequent updating of death information, felon information, and we actually did that in the 2013 elections. And was that timing and the usefulness of that data, being provided more frequently, did that actually meet the objectives of what we're kind of hoping for through 1303? And are there any post-election findings on that? Not so much a technical issue, more a business process issue, but the technology that supports that, maybe we need to take a look at that. The sixth item, potential software changes due to legislation that we haven't seen yet, legislation that may come up in 2014. Specifically, one potential topic is around residency requirements. Around special districts and municipalities, there are different kind of windows under which people need to have been registered to participate in an election. And I have heard that the Special Districts Association at least may be pushing for legislation to provide some clarity around those residency requirements. So we're kind of betting on the come, right? And trying to keep our eyes open for the potential of those types of changes around residency and how the state voter registration system may or may not track that, and then what sort of human behavior and human processes need to be in place in individual counties as they're running elections. Seventh, timelines for registration. There are different timelines based on whether you register by mail or with a VRD versus going to the online voter registration system website that our office hosts versus showing up in person, which you can show up in person same day, register, and then be issued a regular ballot to go ahead and vote. Signature, the number eight, signature interfaces. Some counties actually scrape signatures off of the mail ballots. They electronically capture those signatures and use those for signature comparison with currently registered voters. That process right now is it's based on file transfers and batch processing of files, both for counties to set up their systems to capture and compare those signatures, as well as after the fact to take those new post-election validated signatures and add those to score for future signature comparisons. And so the question was brought up last time, could we improve that integration? So it's not, kind of a batch file transfer thing, but it's actually something a little more sophisticated. Maybe it's a web services, maybe it's, XML, but maybe there are, more sophisticated ways of actually managing those signature interfaces. I will group 9 and 10 together from our list. It's acceptable use policies and then security and network guidelines. Acceptable use policies are really around We have a couple of varieties of that, at least a couple. We've got temporary election workers that may be pressed into service to help run elections, you know, just during that peak time. And then we've also got kind of management, you know, of local election officials' offices. And so we've got kind of business leads, and then we've got technology leads around the security of the systems that people are using, you know, to access voter registration information, to give folks credit for voting and that sort of thing. I think they're closely linked, because acceptable use policies have to, you know, be in an environment where we're aware of how these things are being used and what sort of best practices people are being guided to use. So I kind of group those things together, even though clearly policies are separate from guidelines. Number 11, we talked about the possibility of leveraging cloud-based resources for voter service and polling center operations. You know, for 50 weeks out of any given year, you know, from our perspective, kind of managing the central infrastructure of SCORE, we see a totally different usage pattern, you know, for 2 weeks out of the year than we do the rest of the year, every even year at least. And the ability to rapidly flex up and flex down without, you know, investing in infrastructure that runs idle most of the year, you know, i.e. moving to cloud-based kind of services, seems like a natural fit, right? And then the last piece that we discussed is really the recommendations report. The commission has to provide a report to the legislature on January 15th. That's, let's see, just over a month from now. The language in the statute, I think, says that the January report needs to build on the two prior reports. We should be incorporating some key learnings from the 2013 elections in terms of mail ballot handling, in terms of the impact of same-day registrations and changes to registrations, and then any other topics that the commission chooses to address within that report. This is kind of what I started with. I mean, is discussion on these topics? Everyone feels great. Okay, moving on. So I do want to come back, and we actually have an active evaluation on an electronic poll book. We posted an RFP in November. Responses were due last Thursday. We did, even before that, we posted an RFI, request for information, so that we could, we had five responses to that, I believe, so we could actually make sure we were asking for the right sorts of things as we were posting an RFP for an electronic poll book. And essentially what we were asking for is commercial products or vendors that had products or expertise in developing electronic poll books that were network connected, that would allow addition of new registrations, changes to existing registrations, indication of the correct ballot style that needs to be issued to someone based on, you know, walking in and registering or maybe changing their address, looking up the correct ballot style based on a residency address. If someone needed to be issued a provisional ballot because you couldn't determine eligibility right there. We did get six responses in. Rick Matsumoto, who's a member of this group and of the commission, he's one of the evaluation team. We have two folks from counties that are members of that evaluation team, and then several folks from our office on that evaluation team. And again, it's an active evaluation, so we can't say too much about it. I will say some of the responses are much more expensive than we'd anticipated based on the RFI responses and based on what we'd heard from some of those vendors before we'd published an RFP. And so we have not disqualified any of those, any responses based on cost alone. We will continue with an evaluation of those. And we've actually got, we have in-person or web-based oral presentations scheduled with five of the six. We're waiting for a response from the sixth as to an appropriate time. And those are either later this week or very early next week for that evaluation team. I expect that we'll have scoring on those six proposals, both on technical and business proposals, as well as cost proposals, hopefully by Christmas Eve. So we can actually then be in a position to make a recommendation to the secretary as to, you know, where to go in terms of those responses. Cost may be a factor, just based on what we've seen. Amber?
Trevor, on that, has the decision to do an e-poll book been made, or is this still, because there is an in-person voting module in SCORE, and it's my understanding you guys have been developing that further, and I think there's some new things in the new release. And because I guess from a process perspective, given all of the variables in the way that we're conducting the election now, and we have to be able to immediately determine if someone has already returned their mail ballot or what have you, using a separate e-poll book, I'm concerned about the transfer of that data, including CDOC, CDPHE, DMV registrations, OLVR, mail ballots being verified in other counties. So I'm not familiar. I mean, I've looked at a lot of different, you know, e-poll books for other reasons, and I'm not familiar with one that has sort of those abilities. So I'm wondering if, has a decision been made to go to an e-poll book, or are we still considering potentially SCORE and the in-person module? Because that worked pretty well, I think, for counties last year and this year, and it's really not much different.
Sure. So, no, the decision has been made as to whether to go with a commercial electronic poll book. The way that SCORE handled in-person voting this election, personally, I don't think is going to work in 2014 with the turnout in a gubernatorial election, or in 2016 for a presidential election, just based on the number of voters that we expect to participate. We've seen in the past, so in the past, we've run essentially two different kinds of elections. I'll throw early voting out, but essentially two kinds of elections on election day. Vote center elections, right, which is an electronic poll book. I mean, whether that electronic poll book was the SCORE vote center module or whether it was one of the third party options out there, but that's what it is. It's an electronic poll book, requires network connectivity, although some of them have some disconnected from headquarters functionality, right? But it does allow changes to address, and it does give credit for voting, and it does figure out the correct ballot style for voters right there. And it even handled emergency registrations. So if someone had to emergency register, whatever the process was that a county followed for that, whether they made them go back to a main office to actually provide that form, or whether, you know, however they would actually manage to enter an emergency registrant into SCORE, that vote center module, that electronic poll book, would then pull up that record and show that that person's eligibility had been checked and determine the correct ballot style for them. That was a web-based application, not a Citrix-based application. What we did for 2013 is we essentially took SCORE's early voting module, which uses Citrix, you know, kind of as the way to deliver that functionality, and we modified it to support in-person voting for an odd year election. And we felt comfortable doing that. The user load that we saw in the odd year was pretty much what we saw in 2011 when 58, maybe 59 counties ran mail ballot elections, where there wasn't really an option to even walk in and vote in person, right?
Well, no, there always has to be because of
DRE,
the ADA compliance,
right,
piece,
right.
But yeah.
Yeah, but 1303 is not, you know, a mail ballot election with the option of DRE, I think. Yes, everyone is mailed a ballot, but they can choose to walk in and vote a paper ballot,
yes,
not just a DRE ballot,
yes,
right? So the user load, you know, in 2013 looked pretty much like 2011 did. The user load in the last general election was around 1,350 users, right? Not including vote center users, of which there were at least 800 just using the SCORE-based vote center, not the couple of large counties that used a third-party electronic poll book. So, I mean, the long-winded answer to the question is, I don't think that a Citrix-based implementation will support the number of users that we're expecting based on how many voter service and polling centers need to be set up, you know, under 1303 for either a gubernatorial or a presidential election.
So I think part of the reason, I'm assuming you're talking about users, but you also mentioned that the module didn't work as you wanted it to. A couple things on that. I mean, the module, the early voting module has always been clunky, and primarily it was because SCORE was designed without much input from a business process perspective. So there's a lot of clicks required. And so I think that module, just from a processing a voter's perspective, changing the design, the layout, and sort of what it does and how it functions could save time, process more voters easier, right? There's some system modifications that could easily be addressed. We've had a spirit ticket. This is from 2008. This has nothing to do with 1303. So I guess my concern is, I know you guys did some analysis on the number of users required, potentially required for 2014, which I know hasn't been revisited. And I know, like with us, we're going to actually, because of some modifications we're making internally with, and we're one of the biggest counties, so modifications we're making with equipment, we're going to need a lot less people internally in SCORE. So I think revisiting the number of users counties expect might be a good thing to do at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I guess I'm concerned about the timeline for an e-poll book and figuring out all of these, because it needs real-time access. I mean, we need to be able to register a voter, you know, and do all of that. And I haven't seen a third-party e-poll book be able to do that effectively. So I'm concerned about that part. So I guess, you know, I definitely want more discussion. And I also think that if we're going to do it, it needs to be in by the primary, which is 5 months from now. So
yeah,
I
think that's where the number five, which is data interfaces, came in with discussion.
Yeah.
Last time was, we've got to have a way that third party or whatever it is has a way of communicating back with SCORE. And currently I don't know that that exists for the e-poll book, third party e-poll book to even access any of the data coming from SCORE, mm-hmm. other than maybe a download or whatever, kind of an offline thing. I agree with Amber. It's really got to be a real time. The data changes too quickly, and we need a kind of a connected e-poll book. Now, whether that's an upgraded interface from provided by the Secretary of State's office that maybe has some different options, including a tablet based or something a little bit more portable. That's just kind of a front end to whatever that data conduit is going to be. Either way, there needs to be some sort of a data interface that's available. And to my knowledge, there isn't one right now, other than what's been internal, which kind of leaves the third party poll books just kind of hanging out there and not, I don't know if they'd be functional enough to really meet the needs of especially the larger counties, where things can change very rapidly.
Sure. Well, I mean, on those fronts, so one thing we did learn from the RFI, and which, so we asked, you know, respondents to give us information, is there are essentially two ways that electronic poll books, at least from the community that responded to our RFP, are actually used. First, they would set themselves up as the authoritative source of voter registration information that requires that their electronic poll book be the only means of interfacing with them, right? We think that's probably not allowed under state law in terms of the centralized voter registration system being the authoritative source of voter registration information. To set those up with some of those electronic poll book vendors, you hand them a data extract. Right. And then they would manage that. And then at post-election, they'd return the information back to SCORE in terms of who showed up, what ballot style was issued, you know, who was added, who changed their address, that sort of thing. We're not really considering doing that. The other way that, and all of these electronic poll book system vendors have said that they've got experience with using web services as the way to exchange that information. So SCORE would remain the authoritative source, but information could be retrieved, changed, added, you know, based on, you know, voter service and polling center activity during those 2 weeks, including election day, right? That's where we're going. That's essentially the development work that our folks have actually been putting some effort in on, is actually taking those interfaces to SCORE and adding on web services components so we can actually accommodate that. Because we think that's probably the best way to actually approach that problem, instead of requiring that we change that Citrix module for early voting and purchase more Citrix licenses and plan for more Citrix servers to support what is a relatively clunky early voting module that was developed with a lot of county input. I mean, I remember that you were on the team that, you know, kind of participated in pulling those requirements together. I wouldn't say that it meets every requirement, but I would say that it has worked successfully since 2008. But we don't think that's the right solution, mainly because the age of that Citrix-based SCORE code base today is about 8 years old. And so investing time in an older version of a .NET framework and on an older application to modify it for 2014 and 2016 and beyond, we actually think probably moving towards an electronic poll book that does provide a better user experience, it does accommodate more mobile devices, is probably where Colorado should be going.
And have you looked at any other states? Because I know like Oregon has a web services app that they utilize during their elections, their all-mail ballot. Mm-hmm. And they also use that same app when they're uploading signatures from like ballot sorting type equipment where they're capturing the signatures. Mm-hmm. Have you looked at Oregon and what, because I'm not sure what technology it is that they're using, but I know it's a web services app.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, we have had discussions with other states. Oregon is actually a state that is using the same code base that Colorado purchased from the same company, okay. Sabre Software, which was purchased by HP, purchased by EDS. So, yes, we have had conversations with other states.
Is their web app a different vendor, or is it part of Sabre's system?
I don't know off the top of my head. I haven't been in those conversations with other states about how they're approaching that. We do think, and I think it's supported by the responses we saw to the RFI, I don't believe there's another state that's actually using a statewide electronic poll book. I think most implementations, they may be very large counties, but I haven't seen that we've got statewide electronic poll book implementations out there. You know, for in-person voting. Oregon's a great example. Oregon is all mail. Almost all of Washington State is all mail. But Colorado is, you know, we support in-person voting, either paper or DRE, but we do send out mail ballots to everyone. And I think in 2013, at least, that was the primary means by which people voted. I think your original question was, you know, have we decided we're just going to use an electronic poll book? And if you mean, are we going to use a web-based application to support voter service and polling centers as the primary means, I think the answer is yes. If you mean, are we going to support, are we moving away from Citrix altogether? Not for core functionality. I mean, mail ballot processing, you know, I think we're focusing on in-person, you know, voter handling at voter service and polling centers. We're not, you know, doing a rip and replace on kind of the core election setup, you know, mail ballot issuance, mail ballot receiving, you know, processes that SCORE handles today. I mean, does that make sense? I mean, do you have a different opinion?
I think the timing and looking at something like this right now, when we're this close, concerns me primarily because of things that occurred in Denver about 7 years ago, with the same kind of timeline. And with, you know, counties that are using ballot sorting, signature capturing type equipment, when they're using that software, it's an upload back into SCORE. So if they're uploading that data back into SCORE, then it's somehow going to need to get back to the e-poll book to say this person's already voted. So there's going to be all these data transfers happening on election day, which is pretty concerning to me because I think that that adds some vulnerability and risk. And I would, you know, I guess when I'm assessing risk, I would think that it would make more sense to possibly purchase more Citrix licenses or look at that and maybe give more thought into this longer term. I mean, I certainly get that it makes sense to kind of move away from Citrix long term. Mm-hmm. I just worry about the timeline for 2014.
Yeah, honestly, I think in our office we do as well, especially based on some of the costs that we've seen for some of the electronic poll book implementations.
The RFP doesn't really require using.
Oh no, we're not
additional technology.
Right.
Stick with what we have, and I'd say 2014 is probably too soon to try to implement most of these things, since we're still in the RFP process. A lot of the infrastructure is not there. The interfaces aren't there. If you jumped in and tried to force it this year, you'd probably be in the deep scrimshie.
Mm-hmm. Are you simultaneously, while looking at the RFPs, are you also working on the in-person module and SCORE, or you kind of stopped that until you make a decision on which way you're going to go?
Sure, good question. So we're still devoting project time towards developing web services, you know, moving away from kind of file transfer approaches to actually populating data in SCORE. But we're not spending time on an in-person module now until we see whether some of those commercial products, you know, could actually be used for that purpose. And one point you brought up, I don't think we're expecting that we'd see signatures actually being exchanged on election day from voter service and polling centers. You mentioned the data exchanges that would be happening.
The ballot verification. So when mail ballots are being verified, and when mm-hmm. a lot of the big counties are using the ballot scanning and sorting equipment to capture a signature, and then when we say someone's got a validated ballot, that gets uploaded into SCORE, you know, throughout the day on election day. So there's going to be those transfers happening. Well, that information has to get to the e-poll book to say this person's already voted, they can't vote again.
Right.
And that has to be immediate, real time. And so if it's an e-poll book, I'm concerned, I guess, about the transferring and making sure that that all is happening in real time. Because now, I mean, it's easy. It's all in SCORE, right? And mm-hmm. we, you know, can test that. We can click through and kind of make sure that everything works the way that it should. But if it's a separate application, I think there's more risk. So,
well, you're still with a web base. You're still hitting the same data.
If it ends up being web based, yeah.
Right. I mean, you're still not, as soon as. So it's not really going to matter if you're coming in from the Citrix side or if you're coming in from a web base. It's just that's just the front end. That's just your view to exactly the same data. And if the poll books are real time and not kind of a cached,
that's
setup,
right. Yeah.
Which I think a lot of them are.
Right.
They poll in the morning or whatever. You can go out and they're really working kind of in a local mode. That does open up some opportunity for some issues to come up where you could have multiple votes that are being accepted both in the mail side of things and in the in-person side of things.
And it's for that very reason that we're looking at real time,
yeah.
You know, capturing of the fact of voting.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that's great. Because all the e-poll books I've seen they operate basically as a local type poll book. So it's cached in the morning and there's transfers. And that's really my concern is I'd prefer not to have a system doing that, especially on election day.
Yeah.
So,
I don't think it's even allowed
if it's
under
real
Colorado
time,
law.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think the law clearly says real time. So, I mean, I think if we can get to that point, I think it totally makes sense to move in that direction and then just figuring out the timeline right now is, you know, so I'm assuming you guys would want it in by the primary, or would you potentially change between the primary and the general?
We don't want to do that. Honestly, I think the training cycles, so I think the implementation cycle, and then the training of election judges, our experiences, you know, what people have been trained to use and has been, you know, battle tested, if you will, in the primary, you know, is pretty much what you should try to run with in the general. There's not a lot of time, even though there's more time, you know, now between a primary and a general, there's very little time to actually try to, you know, run the primary election under one scheme and then actually run a general in another scheme. Yeah, so we're steering away from that. I will say when we posted the RFIs, of the responses we got back, only one of them said, yeah, I don't think you could actually do this between January and April, because we're targeting end of April, right, for implementation, because 60 days prior to election day, that's pretty much code freeze time, right? Because you can't have screens changing because you've already developed training materials for temporary workers. I mean, 60 days is, I think, the latest that you could do a cutoff.
I would say much more than 60 days.
I was going to say that too.
Maybe a year and 60 days.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
yes, I will agree with that.
Then there's budget. Obviously, we haven't budgeted for this because we have no clue to what it might be. And unless the state is picking up the full tab, jump in here, Trevor, and say yes.
Thinking about it. Yeah.
and then again, that's not already pre-budgeted. The money's not already available for this year. So I really don't see anything changing as far as new equipment, new things that would require new equipment, new training, new things that would help to implement the law with a lot more gracefulness. I think we're really just looking at what can we do to change our processes to deal with what we have. And the guidance that we're primarily looking for is what's going to be acceptable as far as infrastructure, what's going to be needed as far as infrastructure, what do we need for data communications, what security needs to be around those. That's really about the only thing that the counties can accomplish this year. It's just kind of figuring out what and where and how. All the new toys coming down the pipe, those are great, but for this year, I believe realistically, it's just going to be a matter of trying to get the infrastructure set up. Some counties have been doing vote centers, and that infrastructure may already be there. Jefferson County happens to be one that we haven't done vote centers based on we've always struggled to try and find the locations that could handle that type of situation, and we continue to struggle to find those. But what we need is guidance fairly quickly, because we've identified locations, and we've also have to move very soon on these to build that infrastructure, to put the network in place once we know what the rules are. All those details are, because 60 days out is going to be too late to try and change the plan.
Mm-hmm.
As far as our mail ballot side of things, that process for us doesn't change much at all. We were primarily a mail ballot county.
Yeah, what, 80%, 75, 80%?
Like 80%, something like that. So we are already set to handle a massive amount of mail ballots. The only thing we saw differently this year was huge number of mail ballots coming back the last day, as in drop-off. People stopped mailing them, but they just dropped them off in droves for our particular county. That overwhelmed us as far as volume. But internal processes will know to ramp up for that day, because we've got our typical trends, and we schedule based on those typical trends. And when they go way outliers like that one did, then we start struggling just with thinking straight after a while, just from fatigue. So you got two different sides. The counties that haven't dealt with high volumes as far as mail ballot will have to be adjusting for that and building processes to deal with that. The counties that are used to the mail ballot, not much change there, but it's going to be a big change for them trying to find external sites. And it depends, again, on the size of the county and what's all required.
Mm-hmm.
But if you only have to put in one or two locations, that's not a big deal, but we're a little bit more than that.
Sure. So based on the work that the business practices group has put in, have they gathered enough information to have an expectation as to the number of individuals that will be, you know, conducting election activities in voter service and polling centers in the primary and the general in 2014? Because that absolutely influences, you know, which path we go and how quickly we try to get there, right?
You want me to answer?
I think
a survey of the counties of maybe what, you know, what their plans are. I'm sure everybody probably has an idea of how many service centers and therefore users they need for the primary. We have our estimates already for the general that we're using to plan for. I would assume most are probably getting to that point, or if they haven't already. So possibly maybe a survey, because I think you guys, are your estimates for users based on just the minimum requirements and law with a formula, or did you actually survey the counties last year? I can't remember.
Well, I believe that our estimate was based on the minimum required under law, but personally, for my own part, I take that with a grain of salt, because
yeah.
I know that there was a minimum requirement for number of vote centers that counties had to set up. I think there was a formula set in statute. Most counties that I'm aware of that ran vote centers set up more than the minimum.
Well, and there's a big difference that the formula and statute is for the number of locations. And so a county may have one or two users there, or they may have five. So it's, you know, so maybe asking the counties, or maybe this group puts a survey together to get that information. I don't know if that's helpful for you in the evaluation process for the e-poll book or not. But
absolutely. Okay. I mean, so, you know, our expectation is that on election day, we're expecting to see probably pretty much the same number of users that we would see in any general election day, because the vast majority of those users, they're actually not at a precinct-based polling location or in a vote center, because we didn't really see that user activity. Precinct-based polling locations, they're using a paper poll book.
Mm-hmm.
Vote centers, they were using a secure web app to actually, you know, give credit, you know, look somebody up, verify eligibility, issue the correct ballot style, give them credit for voting. So we're not expecting that the centralized usage, which is mostly mail ballot handling, dealing with the odd emergency registration under old law, providing support for people at voting locations, we're not expecting that number is going to drop a lot. I mean, and maybe we're wrong. But that number, again, was, you know, between 1,250 and 1,350. Now, as we're thinking of how many users are we expecting to see, you know, during that time period when voter service and polling centers are open, we're thinking it's that number of headquarters users plus however many stations, you know, voter registration and lookup and vote credit stations a county has set up in those voter service and polling centers. So, yes, if we knew what counties were planning today, then we'd have at least a better idea than we do now of how many actual people, how many actual fingers on keyboards we can expect, and whether, you know, beefing up Citrix at whatever cost that turned out to be is actually a viable approach for the primary and the general in 14.
Do you think, do you want to put out the survey? Is that something you want to do and get county feedback on it?
I don't mind doing that. I mean, I don't think the response rate to surveys that we send out is always, you know, optimal. I was thinking that, obviously at the clerk's conference, which is coming up, I think a week after this report is due to the legislature. I mean, I think that's a really good opportunity to try to get that information in face to face. I'm sure that elections would be happy to put a survey together in terms of, you know, projections and estimates for number of users and how many VSPCs counties are expecting to set up.
Trevor, this is Tim with El Paso.
Business practices was collecting some of that information already.
They haven't collected anything specifically on that
yet. Okay. Hey, Tim, go ahead.
Just a little bit of actual experience. You know, we've had a mess of elections this last year. And I really don't expect an increase in the number of users. We may have additional sites for our VSPCs, and primarily just because of what is required by legislation. What we can actually use and make efficient use of is about a third of what legislation requires. So our VSPCs are going to really be minimally staffed.
Well, that's good information. By minimally staffed, do you mean one or two?
Maybe two. And primarily two, because in case one goes down, the other is still functional. It's a matter of redundancy. We actually, this last election, because it was mail ballot, our vote centers had very little traffic. We were, like Gary, our election day mail ballot turn-in at the drop locations was about one-third of our actual total ballots. So election day was a huge number of paper ballots to gather and count, but there wasn't any network activity because of that.
Sure.
Yeah, the actual voting for our VSPCs was, I think, maybe 600 ballots. For the entire time that it was open. And we did paper ballots and then centrally counted those. That took me all of about 10 minutes to count the VSPC portion of things.
Right.
The other part is, if the people have a mail ballot in their hand or sitting on their table, it comes in great waves as the deadline approaches, even though they've had a whole amount of time to do this. I think we will probably, our expectation is probably, I think, three machines and operators at each of our locations. And we're looking at 25 locations for election day. There's additional staff there. But as far as actual users, concurrent users, that's only 75 users for us.
Right, because you've got additional staff there managing other activities. They're not registering or changing registrations.
Our primary process that we did on election day was changes of address, updates to the records. That's really the only... for the most part, the only people that came in. Unfortunately, the trends that we saw, they all came in the last couple hours of the election, which wasn't very handy either. But you can't change the behavior.
And Gary, of those 600 in-person ballots, that I should probably know the answer to this, but for folks that had address changes that needed to be made, that received a mail ballot, no, where you sent out a mail ballot but it went to the wrong address, or who walked in and wanted to register and met the residency requirement, are all of those contained within those 600, or did you have more address changes outside those 600
kind of in-person votes? There were people who moved from another county and things like that. The updates that we get with I can't think of the right the change of address data helped us clean up a lot. Typically, we see just with our mail ballot, we see 10% every election is undeliverable that comes back to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw considerably fewer. We saw a great deal fewer. I don't have the numbers, but those would be probably the people who ended up showing up at the VSPCs as
sure.
well.
Sure, sure.
So there's a couple of different things that were at play that are cutting down on the number of changes of addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, we were cleaning up those addresses, you know, fairly close to the election. I mean, that was another newly implemented process. And, you know, the more immediate that information we can get, the better we can stay on top of it, the less lag involved, and we should be able to keep everybody up to date on those. That type of process helps us. The timing and the wave that came in was a little rough, but you know, once we're past that, I think going forward, that's going to help cut down it. And I personally would expect that our VSPC's usage will decrease even more through time as people get used to the process of the mail ballot. There are those who are, you know, I'm going to go vote, and I'm going to vote in person. In Jefferson County, it doesn't really matter because they're voting the same paper ballot that comes and gets counted at the very same place, the very same room. But it's a principle to some people that no matter if they have that mail ballot, they're going to come in, and they feel that's the way to exercise their right to vote.
Right.
And that's, I'm sure, a lot of the thinking that was behind giving the option for this kind of hybrid system,
mm-hmm.
where it's not purely mail ballot. but I don't know that we know what we're going to see. I'd say after 2014, we will probably have a good idea statewide what trends are going to be, because we'll have a few elections under our belt. We can say, okay, this is what the people are doing. This is what the staffing should be. And although the 1303 spelled out kind of proportions that we need to put in, you know, I have no idea if those are going to be appropriate, if those are going to be far under or far over.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is as we go down, they'll probably be a little excessive. We won't need as many. And as Tim said, you know, their expectation is minimal.
Right.
We have no idea because we've never opened up that many locations. I think we've had 8 early voting sites open. That's our closest way of relating. And those, we had 2 machines at those, and those were mainly for redundancy. And we would put tens of thousands of people through those in the weeks leading up to the election. some people just prefer to vote that way. And I don't know, it might shift that people start viewing the VSBCs as kind of an early voting site as opposed to an election day site. But then again, they've also got the mail ballot in their hand already, for the most part. So if we go with expected trends and we say, okay, as many people who could show up are based mainly on address changes, our max would probably be 10% could show up at VSBC based on that. Everybody else will already have had the ballot properly delivered to them. And again, with the address changes coming and that functionality, that's diminished as well.
Do you have an idea what the percentage was in terms of undeliverable this year versus, say, 2011?
Not offhand.
But less than 10%.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, it was much less than 10%. Previously, we'd send out 250,000 ballots. We're expecting 25,000 ballots back. And then going through the process of trying to contact all those individuals or follow up with correspondence and things like that. The fewer we have of those type of return issues, the better. So it pays off for us in the long run to stay on top of those type of processes.
Sure, sure. Hey, Renee, what do you have to offer based on your experience and what you've heard from your counties?
Our county, we are just using two VSPCs. We will have a third one on election day for the general election. We mostly did this in-house this last go-around, so I didn't do the training of judges or I just used personnel that you score on a full-time basis. So I am anticipating at least one more user for the 2014 elections, specifically the general.
But you think you can handle the primary pretty much with the staff that you've got on hand today?
Yes, I think I can. Sure. We brought on one temporary for the coordinated. I think I would handle the primary a lot like I handled the coordinated this year.
Renee, did you use the web-based or the Citrix-based? It was in-house with your existing staff, so they were probably more comfortable with the Citrix.
Correct. We used the Citrix-based.
Okay. Which is what we used, and we found very cumbersome. It's
we found it cumbersome as well.
Yes.
And Trevor, I know you weren't at the last Kovami, but I presented a bunch of data, so like the percentages. Did you get a copy? If you didn't get a copy, I can send that to you.
I didn't. I was able to listen to maybe the last half an hour of that presentation.
Okay. Yeah. We saw a little over 2,500 in person, 1,800 of which was on election day, so 74% or so. And then about 70% of all of our changes of address and new registrations came on election day. But really the numbers aren't, even if we would expect, we had a little over 300,000 total votes cast in 2012. In this election, we had 141,000 total. So, even if we double or triple in person, it's still not much really that we'd be dealing with even on election day itself next year. So, I think the data, and I told you this, and it was a smaller election, the data still tells us a lot about how voters act.
Mm-hmm.
And in Denver over the last, few years, we've seen a significant increase in the number of voters that hand deliver their mail ballot to us, primarily because we've expanded the use of 24-hour boxes and drive-ups and those kinds of things. And now we're up to 64% of our ballots are returned in person. Last year it was 52, so we saw a 12% increase this year with probably the additional 24-hour boxes and things like that. But in terms of the volume in person, I just don't anticipate that it's going to be that much. And I agree with Gary. in that it all, you know, it's not just about what we do at a voter service center or on election day. It also is the NCOA and how long we continue to make address changes. So I know on your list you had the timelines for registration, and I know mail, DMV, and agency are probably going to get cleaned up in statute to be 8 days. At least that's what I've, you know, kind of heard. OLVR is still 8 days. However, that's application submitted. So, like, you know, with counties, I mean, it would almost make more sense to continue to have voter registration staffs at the main office continue to look at those things, because then we can't mail a ballot anymore. But if the person comes in, they don't have to do a new form, and they can just vote. You don't have to then process them and score. So it's sort of a quicker process if counties continue to make those changes at the main office. And then we have less to deal with in terms of the service center, because it's really, you walk in, you're, you know, if you did OLVR the weekend before the election, great, we already got it, it's already processed, and we just click issue paper, issue DRE, and they're on their way. Because that was one thing, and I know it's farther down on the agenda, but with OLVR, even though we're deferring those or, you know, what have you after the 8 days, we still had to look at all of them, because if there was a UACAVA in there, we had to get them dealt with and get them issued a ballot through the online system. And so really it makes sense to really keep going with OLVR probably all the way up to election day, just because
you have to look at them anyway.
We have to look at them anyways, and really it's better for the voter because they've already been processed by the time they come into a service center. And we had a lot of voters come in and say, here's my confirmation, I did OLVR a few days ago, but we hadn't done it, so they had to fill out another, you know, application. So it, all of these things kind of tie into the volume that we would expect to see at a service center, and how quickly we can process things all kind of ties into that business process. And then what do we need in terms of technology to support that? So, I mean, I think the data from 2013 is very useful. You know, we can kind of see how many in-person voters there were and what those trends are to prep for next year in terms of volume. And then I think the users, I mean, I think you're hearing different things from different counties on what they anticipate, and having that information for you guys, especially when you're doing the RFP evaluations, I would think would be pretty useful. Mm-hmm. So
is there any indication from other states that have done voter modernization, what voter behavior looks like, and what effects there have been on different voting jurisdictions in an even numbered year election following implementation of a new implementation of a online voter registration, same day voter registration, all the things that we've done, moving to vote center. I don't know if anyone's actually done it quite as ambitious.
Yeah, I don't think any other state has quite gone as far as we have on that. They'll be looking to us eventually.
Hopefully for good reasons.
So on that note, so it's not really around implementation of online voter registration, but it is around another project that our office has been involved with, the ERIC project that was kind of sponsored by, initially, you know, pushed by the Pew Center on the States. So I believe there are 7 states. If there are 8 and I left somebody out, I'm sorry. But Colorado is one of the early states in that ERIC system. It's the Electronic Registration Information Center. So states are contributing information on voters and DMV license holders to a centralized, anonymized consortium, nonprofit association that's kind of patterned after AMVA, you know, around motor vehicle administrators, but more around elections. So Colorado is one of the early states. We sent out a lot of voter awareness materials last year before the presidential election. I can still say last year because it's December. And actually saw huge gains in registrations from those who lived in Colorado, were eligible to vote, but weren't actually registered. So there was a study that coincidentally just came out on the 10th of this month. I can send a link to the study. It was referenced in one of the election blogs that I see. And they were indicating that states that participated in ERIC saw registration rates that were, it was 3.x% higher than states that were not participating in ERIC, and they saw a decrease in the number of complaints from voters who registered complaints that there was an issue with their registration. So that particular project does seem to be effective in terms of getting more people on the polls, maybe not to the polls, but and then also increasing the accuracy of the data, which you would hope that would be one of the outcomes of data sharing to try to, they also subscribe to the National Death Index. They also subscribe to NCOA information. That's the basis of one of the two NCOA comparisons that Colorado does, you know, every 2 months, right? One of them is through ERIC against national NCOA information, and one of them is kind of managed through a company here in Colorado for NCOA information only for people who appear to live in Colorado, right?
We actually tend to try and steer people towards the Oliver and the online self-registration, basically, just because it cuts down on our error rate. Because when you're looking at a paper form, not quite sure if that's a D or a, an O or something like that, yeah. Right? And that is cut down considerably when you're just receiving the data and it's already been entered by the person doing the registration. So that cuts down on the error rate. And then cutting it on the error rate, that cuts down. Again, it kind of flows down where you've got less issues that show up on election day, because these things might go unnoticed completely.
Right.
Misspellings or incorrect address, something like that. So. Anything that we can have to the cleaner data makes it much more streamlined for us internally and the voters' experience on election. Well, I don't know if I really consider it election day anymore. It's election deadline day.
But, and Gary, I've got a question. So you mentioned kind of the droves of people dropping off mail ballots on the last day. Is that any different from prior years when you were running mail ballot only elections?
Oh, yeah. It's, we actually got a very low turnout coming up to this one. So we were expecting a very, our expectations is we have kind of a normal pattern because we are primarily a mail ballot. And we usually have a big spike at the beginning and then it just kind of tapers off and then it starts building back up towards the election day, and the election day is usually the heaviest. In this case, we got a small spike at the beginning and then it just dropped down to a trickle. And it was just, we thought, we're going to be really low for a turnout here. And then election day came around and it just dumped. Fortunately, we were prepared. We had set up additional drop-off locations, things like that. Had already implemented that infrastructure. And we starting to follow in Denver's footsteps and trying to have more drop-off.
More 24/7 kind of drop-offs.
Have it more convenient. I think I probably dropped off my ballot in Douglas County on election day at the drop off there. So I was probably one of those that did the same thing.
Contributed to that.
Yeah. but the convenience of the in-person drop off, I think, is really something that Denver's experienced a great deal of popularity with, and people are really going with that. They feel more comfortable taking the Postal Service portion out of the equation. Mm-hmm. They feel like that is voting right there. There is some distrust of the Postal Service. We seem to get a lot of mail for for them, not for as much grief as they probably take.
Plus you get a sticker.
We send the sticker out in the packet.
People want the sticker.
Remove the reasoning behind that. It gets sent out in our mail ballot packet.
People do want the sticker.
Want the sticker.
Yep.
Moving up to this, to the coordinate election this year, were there kind of education efforts that counties were going to in terms of the fact that everyone was getting a mail ballot and encouraging people, kind of heightening the awareness of 24/7 drop-off locations, more drop-off locations than maybe people were familiar with based on prior elections? And is that something that counties should be moving toward?
To be honest, our biggest educator is Nine News. Of course, they always refer to Denver. If you have a problem, call Denver. which I could be on your phones. But it's the news media seems to be very effective. People are paying attention to the news media. We're at community events and things like that. We have a tent set up, and we encourage people we have machines out there to have them update their registration or register through the state website if they haven't, and attempt to educate. But it's really hard for an elections department to get anyone's attention outside of the election cycle. And during the election cycle, there is so much noise coming from everybody saying, vote for me, that we're really pretty much drowned out. When the morning news comes on, we'll see huge waves of change happen just based on something that was on the 6 a.m. news cast or the evening's newscast. If we can have better communication through the press, the media, primarily the news media, I think that's probably where we get the biggest response from. Mm-hmm. We can jump all we want and nobody pays attention, but Gary Shapiro says it and they all head
all of a sudden it's
they
real.
All call Denver.
We didn't do any a marketing campaign or anything, but we did use social media and social networking. That's been a big thing for us in terms of getting the message out. But I think the biggest thing with mail ballots is that your mail ballot packet with your instruction sheet that has all the drop-off location, you're kind of, everybody's getting that information anyways. And so it makes it really easy. And then if they're not registered or they need to update their address, it used to be really difficult. It was, did you do this by this date? And here's what your options may be. If you didn't, then here's what your other options are. Now it's going to a service center because basically they can get everything taken care of. So I think the messaging has made it, much easier. There probably isn't too much more from a technical support of that, because that's kind of individual counties doing different things. But I think the push to go vote and getting people to go through that portal to update their addresses, as soon as they move, and then using NCOA has helped from a data perspective, with less undeliverables and things like that. And then our big thing in Denver is Ballot Trace, as you're aware, Trevor, and that messaging tool. We don't get the calls that we used to get. Our number one call in 2008 was, where's my mail ballot? It hasn't come yet. Did you get it? Did you count it? Blah, blah, blah. And Ballot Trace is now proactive and gives all that information so they don't have to call. So our goal really, at least in Denver, is calls to clicks. That's kind of how we call it. If we can get the information through the voters to the website, social media, or through Ballot Trace, then they don't have to kind of pick up the phone and call us. And they potentially don't have to come into a service center, but if they need to, then that service is there for them. So it's definitely made it easier.
A question on kind of locations and planning for VSPCs. Do counties feel, and in terms of maybe what could be included in the recommendations report of the commission delivers to the General Assembly, are there areas where that report should highlight the need for technical support, development of best practices, around preparation you know, identifying good locations and what is a good location. I mean, are there areas where we could chime in on that? I mean, are counties well prepared to understand? Because everyone can do the formula, right? How big is my county? How many DMV offices do I have? How many locations do I need? Well, how many people do I need in each of those locations? And what do I need for them, right? I mean, our counties, do they feel well prepared as they're making those decisions, which you're probably starting to make, or at least thinking about making?
I don't know if we can get much guidelines as far as countywide goes, because that really varies a huge amount.
It's going to vary, but I think that there's definitely counties that have experience with, you know, how to do it right and best practices. I think there's probably a lot that, I think that, you know, some sort of maybe technical setup guide, quick guide type thing to give counties guidance. Because like I know in Denver, we've got a great system worked out with our technology services department. We have what we call technical kits that include certain elements. So your switch, your laptops, your dynamos, your phone. I mean, everything, you kind of have a kit that gets prepped prior to the election. So there's definitely, I think, some best practices that I think it would be great for this subcommittee to, you know, put something like that together, that maybe it ends up being a quick guide or something that would act as a resource to counties for how they approach this. Because there's definitely counties that maybe haven't done, you know, some of this setup before, or at least not to the extent. Now, I know a lot of counties are going to use their existing, you know, motor vehicle locations or locations that are already kind of set up. We don't have that option because we don't manage motor vehicle in Denver, but we set up a lot of sites. We have, you know, we had 13 early voting sites last year for the general. So, I mean, we definitely are used to this kind of setup. We provide iPads to our supervisors, which is a whole nother, you know, use, and it's more of a communication tool. But there is sort of this, you know, how do you get the technology infrastructure right? And I think some sort of quick guide for counties would probably be pretty useful with some recommended, you know, ways to go about doing that.
Yeah, I would agree. A guide kind of for best practices for technical side of things, I think would probably be most helpful. Something that's a tool so that the counties could evaluate on their own. They say, okay, this is what you're going to need. Mm-hmm. Here's the specifications for your infrastructure. And here's how to evaluate that. And maybe here's some resources for getting some of these things, and you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe an acceptable product list or something along those lines. Like, there's different products out there. say, for instance, what I've been looking at is some wireless products from a company called CradlePoint. I'm sure there's many others, but they have the ability to really segment off and they already have the security built into them, where they can be wireless and
secure,
still very, very tightly secured and easily controlled and mm-hmm. properly locked down. Whereas, if you just say, well, you gotta be on the network. You know, I could go get a little Linksys router and, you know, have just open access to that, or, you know, we'll use King Super's wireless or something like
that. Well, and that's the type of thing we want to advise counties not to do.
Right.
Right.
Right. I think it's better, instead of telling people what not to do, say, here's what we would suggest for best practices, and, you know, here's how this can be accomplished. Not on a really highly detailed level, but just general guidelines and practices. I think that would be, and maybe just how to evaluate when they're looking for infrastructure, the type of systems that are acceptable.
Yeah, and like Trevor, I know we have a specific technical infrastructure project plan for each election. So there's very specific timelines when they do the site visits initially, and then they do a site visit right before, or, you know, the voter service center is actually open to test all the network connectivity. And like just things like that, I think would probably help counties plan and know all the things to think about, you know, all the considerations. And I'm certainly happy to provide a copy of one of our previous kind of project plans, because it literally has all that detail, when you do this, when you do that, you know, and kind of has all those considerations on there.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to be, you know, learned over years of refinement. And of course, it's not really going to fit very well in a lot of the very small counties where they're saying, well, yeah, we're doing it out of the clerk's office by her, you know, that type of thing.
But they don't have a requirement to set up nearly as many voter service and polling centers, right? So they
quite
have
quite often
the scale is different.
Yeah, their office is the same thing as the VSPC, which is also the clerk's office, which is the motor vehicle office,
sure.
The recording office.
Sure, Jonathan Troll.
Yeah, are there? I love the idea of guides and guidelines and technical kits. From a security perspective, just because that is my area, I guess. Are there specific policies and requirements that must be followed to keep the security and the integrity of the voting system? I mean, these are just considered security best practices. You know, if you're going to set up a wireless network, it will have a certain level of encryption that meets, current best practice standards. Is that in place already?
Well, that was kind of breached right before the election.
Well, to be fair, that was an AUP that had been in force since 2007 that we did modify by adding the wireless network component directly in the AUP.
The issue that goes on there is the level of expertise that's even available and the funding that's available to smaller counties. What the state may spend in a day for IT may be the entire county's budget for the year,
mm-hmm.
not just for IT, but for everything. So sometimes it doesn't scale well, and it can, in some counties, they share one IT guy who isn't really, work for the county specifically. He just kind of happens to be, lives in the area, and he can get around maybe once a week or once a month, something like that. So to really put very tight, stringent policies on there can be very problematic, because in the case where we'll say you lock everybody out except for this one individual, if this one individual can't get there for a week, you basically shut down their entire operation. So there needs to be a considerable amount of flexibility. And when it comes to, even though Trevor likes to lump these together, I think, as he said, the
9 to 10.
What was it? The policies and the guidelines. Policies, I think, when enforced from the state to the counties, are very poorly received, because the counties are individual entities in themselves, and they've got their own policies and their own best practices. Now, guidelines, I don't know that any county would say, no, we don't want to go along with those guidelines. And everybody will, I believe, strive to their ability to comply with the guidelines. But policies cause some real issues, because the clerk has to work within a framework where she doesn't control, or he doesn't control, the network resources. And if the county says, no, we don't go by what the state does, that puts the clerk in the position of like, well, we don't control our own destiny, but you're saying that we have to control our own destiny. So, I mean, that puts a great deal of burden and
sure. And
problems along those lines. And so,
no, I completely
appreciate.
That's
where you run into some issue between
sure.
policies and guidelines. I don't know that any county would not strive to get to a level if they know what level the state is desiring. Policies are another issue. Unless you're funding it, it's not something that you really can enforce. Say you got to do this.
And there might be recommended things that counties can do. Because I mean, I know from Denver's perspective, and you're probably aware. I mean, the city has significant security network. I mean, we don't all of our sites. That's one thing we use. We try to use city facilities. They're already on the network. They're already, you know, we don't have that kind of that issue with wireless. That you know, they automatically, all of our laptops automatically lock, and some of those things that you know were listed in there. So I mean, I think there's things like that that are fairly easy for counties to kind of, you know, address if they, you know, have other other issues like Gary mentioned. But I mean, but then like I come from a county who actually I think ours are probably more strict than what was put out by the state. Mm-hmm. So you know, it just I think it's going to depend on the county, but it seems like some minimum guidelines or maybe a way to gauge what counties are currently doing, because I think it is going to be different too.
Let me ask this question, and sometimes it just helps me at least process through this stuff. I mean, let's say that you put out a guideline, and again, guidelines you can either follow or you can't, and a county decides to not follow the guideline and put in an open wireless network and your electronic polling book, the integrity gets compromised during the election from this one county. Who is liable for that? I mean, who would that rest with in terms of governance, responsibility, response? And again, I'm just trying to figure out, you know, because I mean, I think the thing that I've seen is we move more and more to real time, you know, access, sharing data across. Obviously, that opens you up to any weakest link could potentially corrupt your entire poll book, potentially, in a network environment. So I'm just trying to think out loud, you know, how does that work? I mean, what does that look like?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I'd say that the responsibility falls onto the clerk who made the decision to not comply with the guidelines. You can get into an argument about, well, the state should just not let you get into their system if you don't hit their guidelines, but well, then you're kind of saying, okay, this constitutional requirement is not going to be allowed because of a guideline that was, you know, pulled from somewhere else. So, that's why I think there should be best practices and guidelines, and I really don't believe that any clerk is going to resist to that in any way. They're going to do the best that they can to comply. There should be some really low level things that are really no cost. I mean, things like you know, not allowing an open public wireless. That's no cost. That's not really a technology. If you're providing a wireless environment, that's something that doesn't have a cost involved in it. Along with that comes, I think, a question that Trevor brought up is addressed at some point. Does the state have some responsibility in trying to provide some of that expertise for those who don't have the expertise? And that is something that's not funded right now, I think, for the state as far as support goes. Although the state has a support infrastructure, I don't know that there's anybody that the counties can call on and say, okay, can you help me with this? You know, do a site visit. Can you evaluate where we're at? And I think site visits have their advantages to identify maybe where a guideline goes into place. A site visit evaluates the compliance with that, and maybe suggests areas that can be improved. But again, it's really up to the elected official. I'd say the responsibility is on the elected official to comply to their ability.
And that scenario you mentioned was in the most recent AUP, that the clerk had to basically attest that that wouldn't happen. So, I mean, I think by signing that and what have you, I think I agree. I mean, the responsibility goes on, you know, the person responsible for those activities within the county. And I know, like, with our AUP, ours is going to be co-signed by our CIO as well, because there's, you know, we want the city TS department to be involved. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm definitely, you know, not trying to push the blame on anyone. It's just in developing and obviously understand the fiscal restraints, but just trying to think out loud whether there's some, like you said, no cost or low cost options, things that hopefully are already built into the technology that you either own or you procure. But, you know, that they're just some agreed upon, you know, secure configurations that, you know, like you said, you know, you'll change the default password so it's not easily guessable and you know, right, things like that.
Yeah, those type of, and those are things that should be done even in a home environment. Not everybody does, but.
Right, absolutely.
You know, those are just really the most basic of the best practices. You could, I would say, guidelines that we'd like to see is, you know, is WAP, is that acceptable? Or what level of wireless encryption is acceptable? What do we need to look for in a product? If we're buying a product,
sure,
to fit this need, what is it that we need to be looking at? Of course, we do take Jefferson County takes the view that we're responsible for any data corruption or breaches that happen in our ecosystem. We're not looking to say, well, the state didn't stop us from doing that, so therefore it's the state's problem. It's really looked at it's our duty to keep that safe and secure. And do the best that we can to follow the guidelines that are laid down by the Secretary of State.
So I think I know we're rocketing upon or just past the time we kind of allocated for this, and I don't mind going a little over, but I do want to try to be mindful of the time commitments. So here's kind of what I've captured in terms of working. I think business practices is meeting tomorrow afternoon, I think 3 to 5. I think that I'll be attending that meeting. In terms of working together with them to try to take information to contribute to that recommendations report, the things that are standing out to me based on our meeting today is obviously, you know, the feasibility and then the risks around, you know, using an electronic poll book, right, as opposed to, you know, additional Band-Aids, maybe more, making the existing in-person early voting module, you know, and try to use it next fall. You know, what's the feasibility of electronic poll book or leveraging Citrix and beefing up that infrastructure? What are the risks around that? I think that's somewhat influenced by the evaluation of the RFP responses that we've got. And obviously, we don't have to pick somebody as a result of an RFP, but we could, right?
I think if you did pick somebody, I think you'd see almost zero implementation this year, from budgetary, and no one wants to jump into that in the middle of. Well, I mean, there's already a great deal of change. They're already going to be doing a big shift.
Sure,
Trevor can handle it because this is the time frame we have for SCORE.
Right? Yeah, well, although an electronic poll book doesn't necessarily mean purchasing a bunch of mobile devices, electronic poll book can also mean a browser on a. Which I know you already set up for early voting sites.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's part of what dictates how much bandwidth we need.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got kind of a feasibility and risks around electronic poll book, you know, evaluation implementation versus, you know, trying to extend the Citrix-based, you know, module further for the primary and the general in 14. I've got, in terms of VSPC flow, right, and in terms of business practices, kind of looking at that, what does that mean in terms of the number of users, right? I think the number of sites you have to set up, I think there's already a floor on that in the legislation.
There is in legislation.
There may be, counties may be looking to set up more than that floor, I don't know, but in terms of how many people they actually want manning kind of, you know, registration, change in registration versus handling voting, you know, drop off, you know, that sort of thing. What does that mean in terms of number of users, right? I mean, that's a fact we need. I did get a text from someone that said we have issued a survey asking for projections for 2014, but we probably should say, well, what did you have in 2013, right? I think Vicky's already got a survey out on 2014, kind of estimates.
And that's going to be a decision that each county needs to make for themselves.
Yeah.
Because if there's long lines and there's backed up, people don't yell at the Secretary of State. They don't yell at the legislature. They
yeah.
yell at the court.
Absolutely. Because CNN doesn't come here when that location is overloaded. They
right.
go there.
They're
right?
looking at the county level, and that's as far as the blame goes.
Right.
So.
I think that, you know, there's been some discussion about NCOA and actually trying to make changes, you know, pretty frequently and trying to respond to new information quickly rather than slowly, and how that can help kind of minimize the number of undeliverable ballots you've got and making sure that those new registrations that come in, maybe that timeline shortens, maybe it doesn't, but at least making sure that you've got the best information at the best possible time, right, for when someone actually walks in or they request a mail ballot. So I think that's something we ought to make sure that is highlighted.
It's going to level off our workload.
Yeah.
So we don't have these big spikes and then, you know, get behind on everything else and spike again.
Right. I think locations and planning still, I mean, I like the idea of, you know, how do some counties do this well? Maybe a tech kit, you know, a tech guide, you know, so that we can provide some guidance to the counties that haven't set up, you know, remote locations frequently in the past. What do you look for? What makes a good location? How do you need to prepare for that, right? I like, it's not really a tech thing, unless you're thinking about camera coverage, right, and how you actually facilitate that, but 24/7 drop-off. But it sounds like that's something that Denver feels is, that's something really good that you can kind of bring attention to, that, you know, you don't have to come only when you would normally be at work. You can come by any time, right? I think that may be something we want to focus on. The timelines for dealing with registration changes and whether those should change or not. If that's something that potentially could end up in the report from the commission.
Yeah, I don't know what this group has to do on that. But
I don't think we have anything to do with it.
I don't think you have anything
yeah.
other than you're going to have to support whatever gets changed.
Right.
I think that was
right.
a question that was actually brought up by Max Tyler. He wanted to know, how did it work with the timelines as they were written?
Sure, sure.
Because that's one of the things that he'll be looking at, actually.
Right. Interfaces, whether that's to an electronic poll book, to signature systems, to CDOC, to CDPHE, to revenue, right? I think interfaces is an area that deserves some attention. And then this idea around security policies, you know, acceptable use policy. Well, that's something that in the past we've always expected to see that signed, right? You're agreeing. Whereas guidelines are more, well, they're guidelines. You're not held to something. There's no signature block on it. But they are things that you ought to be aware of, maybe you'd be thinking about, even if it falls short of a policy, right?
Yeah. Well, acceptable use policy, I think what we ran into was we needed to separate the use from the infrastructure.
Well, and I think that's...
It was behavior and it was responsibility of what an individual in front of the system could do, separate that out from what it was that they're sitting in front of. They
absolutely. Control. Yeah. And to kind of Amber's point, she said, well, that was actually co-signed by the CIO, right, and the clerk, because, you know, it's probably going to be an IT person that says, yep, they're patched. Yes, I'm preventing, you know, someone from just surfing to, you know, badvirus.com, you know, but it's actually the probably the elections professional that's saying, yeah, my people have gone through training. Yep, they have complex passwords because I force them to have complex passwords, and they're knowledgeable about their job. They don't turn the screen around and show it to someone standing in front of them.
Right.
It's shared responsibility, I think. So yeah, good point.
But uses behavior of the individual. How is that individual going to use that information? And that very definitely needs to have a policy. That's something that needs to be well defined.
So Trevor, I was trying to streamline the big long list. So it seems like there's four categories. There's security and kind of all that sort of fits under there with the AUP and guidelines and what have you. There's data, NCOA, statistical type information as it relates to what people are doing, technical logistics, so locations and planning and infrastructure and all that needs to go with that, and then systems, so score, e-poll book. Those are kind of the four categories, at least, that I've heard today that it seems like a lot of this fits under as sort of how we can move forward in terms of those, because I think those four areas are probably the most important for this group.
Sure.
You know, to kind of look at least that's what I heard, but.
Sure. So, I mean, if there's no objection, I'll take this forward to business practices tomorrow. Again, 3 to 5, the full commission is meeting this Friday. And then I think Hillary Hall manages the business practices group, and I'll spend some quality time with her in terms of how we pull this together. The recommendations report from January builds on the two prior reports and incorporates learnings from 2013, right? The two prior reports, the one that's relevant to the stuff that I have any knowledge about, because I don't know voting systems, it's not a huge lift to craft a January recommendations report, honestly. Actually, achieving that work is something completely different, of course. But I don't know that we have a huge lift in front of us in terms of putting the commission in a good spot, you know, based on the stuff that we've kind of talked about. Actually making it all happen is a different matter, though. Any closing comments before I bring this to a close? Anyone still on the phone?
Tim?
No, we're good.
Okay. Thanks, Tim. Hey, thanks everyone for joining today, and I'll send out these meeting notes as well as after Hillary and I, after I've attended BPG tomorrow, I'll send out some notes from that as well. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah.